Army is kicking out more soldiers each year because of misconduct. The rate of expulsions tripled over the past 3 years. Kate Kidder is a research assistant for the Military Veterans and Society Program at the Center for a New American Security and my guest on Pentagon Solutions today. Kate, it is great to have you on the program today. The comments that General Odierno made about the Army and the composition of the Army, I think, are interesting because he really got very candidly at the heart of the situation the Army's been in the last couple of years. The backside of this is something that your colleague Phil Carter and I have talked about before, which is what happens to these people who leave the Army and the other branches of the military because of what Phil and others call bad paper. You've done some work on that. What do you find when you look at that, Kate?
Well, I think that when you look at, you know, the position that the services are in, to include the Army going forward with the demand for drawdown and lower end strength numbers at the end, I think on the one hand, we have a situation where we want to preserve the integrity of the all-volunteer force, and we want a healthy amount of competition in the system, particularly as we're in a struggling economy and the services can be more selective as supply outweighs demand. But I think there's also on the backside, it must be balanced and fair. It must be treated as balanced and fair. And there are implications for this strategy of increased amounts of soldiers pushed out for misconduct issues who are going to face greater challenges upon separation than perhaps their counterparts who aren't being pushed out would be in the civilian economy.
The piece that Phil wrote in the New York Times back in November, he cited 76,000 soldiers approximately that the Colorado Springs Gazette found were discharged between 2006 and 2012. But only one in seven were criminal convictions. Now, when we look at this story on federalnewsradio.com this week about the numbers that General Odierno spoke to, they kind of all lump together the reason for the discharges. And it strikes me that if one in seven were kicked out because of criminal convictions, that meant six of seven were discharged for things that would be in regular society not thought to be as severe, not thought to be as difficult to deal with, especially if you're an employer thinking about hiring somebody or something like that. What kinds of changes does the concept of bad paper cause in somebody's life once they leave the military, Kate?
Well, I think it makes it more difficult for them to engage in the employment process to begin with. So, you know, if someone is applying for a job and is coming out with a negative DD-214 that hinders their chances at employment. What we've also seen is an interaction then between lack of employment and also just kind of a concept of wellness, the ability to pursue life as their counterparts do, to pursue employment and wholeness. And so there's kind of an interaction effect there that leads to kind of a slippery slope and makes it more difficult in the future to apply for jobs. And then also an interaction there between the bad paper and the inability to find employment and some of the mental health issues that are plaguing the population.
The term that you use, the concept of wellness, I think is interesting because it implies a holistic approach to life after the service that I'm not sure until just maybe very recently either the Pentagon or maybe the VA was focused on it more than DOD, but it seems to me that that's probably a relatively new development. Is my deduction correct there, Kate?
We've had some colleagues do some work on wellness, veteran wellness in the past here at CNAS, looking at the concept of, you know, what does it mean to be integrated both physically and mentally and with employment and being engaged in kind of the normal processes of wellness within civilian life.
The focus, though, in the past, it strikes me, within the agencies has been more on, when we talk about wellness or wholeness, has been on
correct,
the physical health. And the idea of someone being able to go back into society after his or her service has concluded has been not as heavily emphasized as it now seems to be. Is that a fair statement on my part, do you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you look at DOD, when you look at the services, I mean, it's in their best interest to have a person who's fully integrated with mental health and physical health and mental aptitude and intellectual aptitude. It's in their best interest to build someone who is able to withstand the great deal of pressures that come not only with being in conflict zones, but also in leading change within the institution. I think that part of the difficult part of transition is that those who don't meet the standard are ones who are, as the article from yesterday points out, those are the ones that are kind of being shifted to the margins or pushed out of the services. And in some cases, that is also making them ineligible to receive VA benefits.
There's a context here, too, that I wondered about, and I wonder what you think of it. The story on federalnewsradio.com says the number of enlisted soldiers forced out for drugs, alcohol, crimes, and other misconduct shot up from about 5,600 in 2007 as the Iraq War peaked to more than 11,000 last year. But that's out of a force of, what's the army now, about 550,000 soldiers. So that's, relatively speaking, it seems to me that's not a huge amount in the context of how many people are in the service as a whole.
Correct. And I think, you know, in one sense, the increasing misconduct charges reflect a positive trend in that there's a greater awareness of the different types of struggles that maybe have started to creep into the military services. I think, you know, to look outside of the article from yesterday, even just looking at reporting rates of military sexual assault, which has been largely in the news, the increased reporting rates may not necessarily indicate a larger amount of sexual assault, but rather a larger awareness and capability within the services to root out what the issues are.
Well, and a larger comfort level among the people reporting them that somebody might actually do something about it.
Correct. And so I think it also indicates a great deal of cultural change, which I think is what we're really after here. So a number of policy changes can be made, but really the force that the policy changes have is when, you know, there's a shift in the culture that comes from the top down and that's sustained from the bottom up.
So you make a good point there, Kate, that there are in all of these kinds of numbers or research or whatever, there are extraneous circumstances. When we look at this story about the Army, are there other things there that you can think of that we should be keeping in mind as we're looking at these to add some context to what we're seeing here?
Well, I think certainly getting back to the pressures that the services are under to kind of to minimize and draw down as they go forward, I think another thing to keep in mind, again, back to the culture piece, is that not only, you know, are the services incentivized by keeping the greater, more human capital and the individuals who are going to perform the best and provide us with the most effective fighting force for the investment. I think there's also a level of the military, you know, if the economy starts to gain traction again, I think the military also faces the risk of losing those high talent individuals if the culture and the climate is not supportive of, you know, those who are really pursuing excellence in what they're doing. And I think, you know, part of the conversation has also been there's been a lot of talk of this sacrificing character for competency over the last 12 years while we're fighting the wars. But I think when it comes to the concept of a service member and, you know, being able to sacrifice character for competency, I think it's a false dichotomy because essentially when we look at our service members, particularly those in the battlefield, I think they're the front line of U.S. foreign policy. And so what comes through and the character issues become a competency issue.
Kate, I want to continue this conversation in a minute and talk more about the work that you've done on what happens to these folks afterwards and what to do about it. We'll do that when we come back on In Depth with Frances Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. My guest on Pentagon Solutions today, Kate Kidder of the Center for a New American Security. We'll be right back. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. Pentagon Solutions today with Kate Kidder, the Center for a New American Security. And the focus of our conversation is about the story on federalnewsradio.com about the Army getting rid of more soldiers than they have in the past 3 years, more than triple the number of soldiers leaving the military, 5,600 in 2007 and 11,000 in 2013 because of misconduct. And Kate and her colleagues at the Center for New American Security have done some pretty in-depth research into what happens to these people after they leave the military. Kate, was there an overarching theme to what you saw happen to the folks that leave, not just the Army, but all the branches of the military because of misconduct? Was there kind of a standard thread, or were the stories so disparate that it's really hard to categorize them?
I think there's a number of issues that lead to service members leaving, leaving the military on misconduct charges and with bad paper. I think one of the things is that the standards of the military are, and as they should be, higher than those of civilian courts. And so I think there's a number of individuals who get in trouble under something that's a military offense that may or may not have gotten them in trouble in the civilian sector. I think there's also an element of there's debate about whether or not the war itself is something that is driving increased misconduct rates within the military. But I do think that we can say that there's at least an interaction between not just the war experience, but also the experience of multiple deployments, of unpredictability, of life changes. This cohort, the Iraq and Afghanistan cohort, has one of the higher divorce rates that we've seen in past conflicts. And so I think there are a number of things that intertwine and create kind of a complicated situation.
Those complicated situations can be addressed in some cases by programs the Department of Veterans Affairs offers or support that the Defense Department offers for people who come back but stay in the military even if they experience some difficulties when they do so. But as your colleague Phil Carter writes, he writes about the story of John Shepard Jr., won a Bronze Star for valor in Vietnam, but then got kicked out for disobeying an order to return to combat after he developed PTSD. He went without help from VA for 40 years until he had the benefit of a team of students and attorneys from Yale Law School. Not every veteran has that benefit.
Correct.
And yet they're obviously Mr. Shepard, in Mr. Shepard's case, he did wind up getting some help from some folks who, once they were able to apply some pressure. And by pressure, I don't mean anything nefarious. It's just somebody who was willing to put some elbow grease behind his case. What is the prospect, in your view, of VA being able to do that in a time of limited resources when some veterans who have a clear path to resources from the Department of Veterans Affairs are still struggling a little bit to get that help?
Well, I think that, again, it's a complicated scenario. I think that the VA has the core competency to be able to address that. I think part of the issue is that those service members who are separated with bad paper are more likely to have a difficult time kind of trudging through the system. As you said, I mean, Mr. Shepard went 40 years through the process, and I think that someone, particularly if there's a mental health element leading to misconduct, and then there's the trauma of kind of going through the misconduct charges or court-martial or whatever the process may be that the service member goes through, to the other side, I think some of them end up losing the fight, I guess, losing the will to fight the system that's already complicated.
What are the steps that we would want to see the VA and DOD take to prevent that from happening to the Iraq and Afghanistan cohort? These are folks who are at the beginnings of these processes, and theoretically the agencies are in a position to be able to address those issues now so that these folks don't turn into John Shepard.
I think On the DOD side, there's a complicated balance between when it comes to fighting and winning the nation's wars, the incentive is to maintain the best and the brightest and as it should be, which there's a tension there in how much do you provide for someone as they're, you know, as they're forcibly leaving the service or involuntarily leaving. I think that one of the things that at more at the unit level is a compassionate approach from the command who are the commanders in charge of these proceedings, looking at the full picture, and even if it ends up in a scenario where the service member needs to be separated, I think looking at, you know, solutions, bridging the gap from that moment of separation that's involuntary to mental health services, if nothing else. I think, too, there's a lot to be done at the local level. So a lot of the research that we've done, we visited a number of cities out west, and one of the things that we experienced in the nonprofit sector is that they're the ones who are really picking up the slack. So the VA is not able to take many of these cases, and so individuals are going to community-based services that may not distinguish between honorable, dishonorable, or other than honorable, and who serve a whole range of veterans. They tend to be picking up the slack community-wide and meeting the needs of those veterans in their communities who are either homeless or there's a number of legal assistance organizations that have cropped up, and they look at not only, you know, it provides some legal justice. So if a veteran who's struggling, who has bad paper, has not been, who has actually committed a crime, I mean, there is a level of addressing the root causes of the crime and also addressing the fact that a crime was committed.
One final thought, Kate. I imagine we'll run into a situation we would see a situation either in Congress or among the veteran community of saying, wait a minute, this guy or woman shouldn't be entitled to the same benefits that I get because I served my hitch with no problems and did my duty, honorable discharge, whole thing, and this person didn't pull his or her weight. Is that something that will be easy or hard to deal with, do you think?
I think there's certainly a competition for resources even now. I think that one way of rebutting maybe that claim is that one of the things that I think is most important in addressing is the issue of mental health care. And so I think, you know, there are a number of benefits that come with being a veteran that are earned and that perhaps, you know, belong with those who have left honorably. But I think the real bridge to the gap there would be making sure there's a provision of mental health services that can serve as a foundation for veterans with bad paper, perhaps to find more holistic help within their community, but to give them the foundation to be able to do that.
Kate, I'm grateful for your time today. This is a complex issue, and I thank you for helping us understand it a lot better.
All right. Thank you so much, Francis.
Kate Kidder's a research assistant at for the Military Veterans and Society Program at the Center for a New American Security. And you can hear my conversation with her on Pentagon Solutions later this afternoon at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.